It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 450 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. And it's a big 450. We're celebrating by having a great Kickstarter doubleheader. First up is Ben Slabek, the creator of Exilium, and he has a Kickstarter going on for that right now. It's called Exilium, the hit sci-fi series returns for season 2. Now it's going to conclude on Tuesday, September 8th at 3 in the morning Eastern Time. So don't delay, now's the time to get out there and support this wonderful science fiction series. The 40-page first issue of a new limited series you don't want to miss is how it's described. It's a sci-fi action series taking place in the late 21st century that's returning for a second season following a highly successful 6-issue first season from Alterna. As we discuss, you can get the 224-page Season 1 graphic novel as one of your rewards. I've already contributed, and I highly encourage you to do the same. Then everything wraps up with Roadkill Rampage, as I talk with Rodney Fike, the writer and artist from Cincinnati, Ohio, who has written this book, and Eamon Hill is the artist. Now, this is a little different because the Kickstarter is actually concluded for Roadkill Rampage. We look back on the Kickstarter and how it went, as well as talk about how you can get Roadkill Rampage. Here's how Roadkill Rampage is described. It's a mature horror story following the journey of Ace and Tess, a young couple taking a drive out to the country. Ace, being the quintessential bad boy, likes fast cars and hot chicks. His classic car and Tess both meet those qualifications. Unfortunately for Tess, Ace has a dark side that she is unaware of. Will they make it out alive? We talk about how this book came to be, how it grew from a one-shot to a mini-series, as well as what's in the future for Rodney and his team. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy what he has to say. There's a lot to get to in this double-sized episode, so let's get on with the show. It's a pleasure to welcome to the podcast Ben Slabek, the creator of Exilium, which has a Kickstarter going on. But boy, that's just one of the things you've done. Ben, you've got 1566 AD, The Mapmaker, goodness, Trail, oh goodness, so many, many good things. Mike and The Fisherman and all kinds of good things like that. So how are you doing, Ben?
Yeah, good. Thanks, Wayne. Great to be talking to you. Thanks for making the time.
It's good to talk with you. Now, this is going to post, and you've only got a little while. This is going to conclude Tuesday, September 8th at 3 a.m. Eastern Time. And so this is going to be something we got to get to right away. I mean, things might have changed by the time we're recording this a little early. But as we're recording this, you have already met your goal for Exilium, and in fact, you have 194 backers. That'll kind of date some of this when people get to look at it. But you're having a big success with this. Now, I read the book. It first came out under Alterna, and I managed to get the collected edition on a nice glossy paper. I'm good with the newsprint, but I like the glossy paper, especially with science fiction stories. I just tend to go in with it. So I'm by the time this goes, you have met your goal, and you're then some. And so by the time you're getting towards the end, that shouldn't stop people from going in and supporting your stuff, because you have got really good stretch goals going on.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks, Wayne. No, it's going well. As I mentioned earlier, I didn't really know what to expect going in funding a single issue. Our previous Kickstarter campaign was for the collected trade of the first series. You know, it was 200-plus pages, which, you know, it was an easier sell. So, but it's going really well, and obviously we've surpassed our original goal. So we've made some additional stretch goals, you know, free digital comic, some posters, trading cards, an even ebook of my upcoming novel. So yeah, so hopefully it will entice backers to jump aboard the campaign before it ends in a couple of days. And there's even a catch-up option for those who missed the first series, so that they're not in the dark, because even though there will be a bit of a recap at the beginning of the second series, it still pays to have read the first as well.
Yeah, I read the first one. Like I said, I ordered the book and I got it, and I loved it. I really enjoyed the story. I'm a big science fiction guy, and I have to tell you, let's just say what's really going on surprised me.
Oh, good to hear. Good to hear. I was hoping, you know, there would be that surprise element. You know, on the surface, it may look like straightforward alien invasion story, but I really wanted to focus on a different element. I hope I succeeded in that.
Well, obviously, if you're doing a second series, that's a good thing. I mean, obviously, the first series must have been successful if you get to do a second one. So that's good.
Yeah, no, it was very successful. I get overwhelmingly positive feedback. I've had, even before we started production on the second series, I received many queries whether we'll be continuing. Definitely, this will be going on for some time. I'm sort of a separate story arc, so mini-series. And in fact, I've just kicked off a spin-off series, or rather scoping out the spin-off series. And there will be somewhat of a prequel, but then it will kind of catch up to existing timeline and, in fact, may cross over with the main series proper as well. So it's actually quite exciting. The art style we're going for is a little bit different, and the artist I'm working with will have quite a bit of input on the overall direction of that series as well. So very excited about that as well.
That's really great, because, like I said, I read it and I was just I was floored by the good surprises and the various characters and stuff like that in it. I wanted to read a little bit about what the book is about, just in case people don't know what it is. And it says the first series saw the first official contact having been made with an advanced extraterrestrial race. On the run from a superior force, they sought refuge on Earth, deeply dividing humanity. Unknowingly leading their oppressors to Earth, the aliens, along with the human faction they allied themselves with, struggled to mount an effective defense. And that's basically what the book is about, which I really like. Now, talk to me about making it. Now, one of the things I'm interested in is the use of like Latin or Latin-sounding words, mm-hmm. like the name Exilium. Do you like Latin? Is that what because at the end of each one of the chapters, there's like what seems to be a Latin word, and I don't know Latin well enough to know whether those are real Latin words or not. Are they?
So, yeah, each episode or issue title is, in fact, in Latin. That kind of, you know, sums up what the theme of the issue is. So I've dabbled with that a little bit before. I had a series called Terminus Aquo, which was also in Latin, meaning point of origin. I thought I was looking for a name. Obviously, Exilium means the exiled, one of the meanings in Latin. And I quite like the sound of it. And, you know, rather than simply saying The Exiled, I wanted a little bit more mysterious title, but that still has sort of an overarching theme, what the series is about. And the focus really is on the Exilium, how they came to be where they are, what impact they've had, you know, without giving away too much for those who haven't read it. I thought it fit quite well.
Yeah, I really did enjoy it. Like I said, it's a great book. You know, some people make a differentiation between science fiction and what they call sci-fi.
Yeah.
That the sci-fi is a little more Star Wars-y kind of, mm-hmm. you know, lighter. This book I would classify more as science fiction than that. I mean, how do you feel about that? Would you prefer it be called science fiction?
Look, I mean, distinction between the two, yeah, there may be some, you know, in the perception of people. I would maybe even lean a little bit towards even a space opera in that sense. But yeah, I mean, as far as I would probably agree with you. That probably would lean more towards sort of science fiction than that Star Wars-y aspect of it that you've mentioned. Yeah, I think you could be right there.
Well, that's the way I like it. Of course, I liked it because of that. Oh, you know, I don't mind sci-fi, but science fiction to me is a little more thoughtful, a little more involved. I have to pay attention.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, growing up, my first memories of watching science fiction TV series and films were primarily like Star Trek, Battlestar Galactica. Star Wars I liked, but I was never, you know, the biggest Star Wars fan out there. I saw that more of as an action flick when I was a kid, whereas Star Trek, you know, starting with series and the motion picture and onwards, Next Gen, I mean, there is a bit more thought around, you know, various themes and the human condition, etc.
Mm-hmm. Which I like. I'm a DS9 guy myself.
Yeah,
I love Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, no, that's one of my all-time favorites, actually.
Oh, man, me too. I love that. I could go into stories about that, but I won't. I won't bore you with them. Okay. But as far as the book goes, there was the main characters are, and I ever since I've read this, I had a question. Now I'm going to get the answer. There's a heroic trio called Nia, mm-hmm. Ken, and then there's the alien guy. Yeah. Is his name pronounced Tru or True?
Ken always teases him. He skips the apostrophe, calls him Tru, whereas he constantly insists it's Taru with that apostrophe. So really, I mean, this was really to pay out the apostrophe that's in use in alien names, you know, a bit of a send-up because it's become a bit of a cliche in alien names. So it's kind of a running gag throughout the series about the apostrophe. And in fact, the whole graphic character down the track even makes a comment that it's a redundant apostrophe. Which makes Taru a little bit angry.
I get a kick. Now, one of the things about him, and of course, he's the character that I was particularly interested in. He looks like what they say Area 51 aliens look like.
Yeah, and that was deliberate, you know, playing on that whole aspect of the greys, as they're called. That you know are said to have, you know, made an appearance at Area 51 in a crash, etc., and all of that. So yeah, this was a deliberate choice of that look and feel of the character.
See, that's interesting because there are connotations about that, mm-hmm. that about those aliens, and when we've seen them in other science fiction and stuff like that, there's. Sometimes they're good and sometimes they're bad. I mean, I remember in Stargate SG-1, they were very advanced.
Yeah, that's right.
And in other ones, I've seen one that they're not quite so advanced. I mean, we talked about Deep Space Nine. They actually go to Area 51 in one of the episodes. And they go back in time and see Area 51 and they talk about that stuff. Yeah. And I'm just always interested about that. You kind of take a middle ground with these guys. They're very advanced scientifically, but as far as like emotional stuff and things like that, they seem to be a little less. I don't know. How would you? Is that accurate? Do you think, or was I wrong with that?
So with Taru, for example, we're dealing with sort of an extraterrestrial that was born on Earth and grew up here, primarily among, you know, human population. So I think that's certainly played a role in the development of his character. So it was his parents' generation that arrived as refugees, you know, on the run from this other powerful force that they don't really know who they are. So while they're quite advanced on the technological front, yeah, there is that aspect that, you know, they're not that dissimilar from us. And there is mention at some points that, you know, that there have been abductions and things like that. So there's certainly that element to them as well, experimentation and all. And one of the reasons why parts of the population on Earth were adamant they will not accept them into the society, leading to a conflict. So there's definitely, there's quite a wide sort of spectrum of their character and of the development of their characters, if you will. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Which is good. I mean, humans are that way. I mean, why shouldn't aliens?
Yeah, exactly. And different characters will behave differently. For example, you know, I introduced another alien character called Buck, and he skips his apostrophe. And in fact, even Ken makes it, you know, an observation, you know, did you hear that? You know, he's just skipped his apostrophe. So, you know, they're different. Some hang on to the tradition, some don't, some assimilate better. So I think that's more realistic in terms of treating them as individuals rather than having a sort of a blanket perception of them being all the same.
Mm-hmm. Which I liked. I mean, I thought the fact that they were actually somewhat different from each other was a very positive thing. I mean, some people I'm sure were going like, oh no, they're all should be exactly the same. Well, humans, like I said, aren't that way. So why should they?
Very different, yeah.
That's really good. Now, I want to get into Ken and Nia because there's something interesting about them. One of the great things about getting the collected edition is that you get the character design evolution pages mm-hmm. on the three of them. And I found that really interesting. One of the things I found interesting, particularly about Ken and Nia, is they both hail from Brazil.
Yeah. So when I first said about writing this story, you know, for some reason, in that opening scene of Teru being chased down the streets, I imagined it to be, you know, in a sort of a favela-type settlement. And then it just kind of developed from there. I just thought there was a kind of a fitting, for me anyway, to open it up there and to set it somewhere where you wouldn't necessarily expect. So so that's why I've kind of and Brazil being a very ethnically mixed society, you know, you have Nia with different backgrounds, you have Ken with different backgrounds. Nia's part, you know, native Brazilian, native African. Ken has some Japanese mixing with in him with South American. So there's a bit of mixing there. Obviously, being a very diverse society there,
mm-hmm. which is good. I mean, that was separate to me and something that made this book stand out because, you know, almost always I read science fiction and it's always Americans, mm-hmm. you know, except for like Doctor Who, everybody's British over there. So to find something from a different country or people who hailed from different places and were a little more diverse was, I thought was actually quite, you know, it made it a lot more interesting to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's what my aim was, to try something a little bit different with the characters and introduce a bit of diversity to show that, you know, in face of a threat such as, you know, foreign invasion of Earth, this would affect all of Earth, not one particular country or region. I mean, I could have, based in Australia, I could have easily set this entire scene in Australia, but I also wanted to maybe go for a region where it may not necessarily be the first choice for some writers. So, I'm glad I did. It worked out well, I think. I like the characters, and, there will definitely be further development in the second series.
Mm-hmm, which is really good. Now, I did have to smile at one of the things in I think the first chapter. You know, Doctor Who I mentioned, they always, when they say that the TARDIS moves, it makes a certain noise. Mm-hmm. And I think that actually when this machine starts to make a noise, it makes the same noise as the TARDIS that are close to it. It goes vorp, which of course is what they say that the TARDIS does. Was that intentional? Were you kind of having, you know, were you kind of alluding a little to Doctor Who when you did that?
I think with my letter is actually based in Britain, so I think that may be a bit of an Easter egg there. Yep.
Yeah, I saw that and I thought, whoop, I said, that's a Doctor Whoism. I said, how'd that get in here? So that's,
that's a good observation, yep.
Yeah. So I think that's fun. I think when science fiction all kind of makes nods to each other, I, as somebody who likes to, you know, read all these different things and watch science fiction and stuff like that, I always get a kick when that happens. And so right away I said, okay, this is going to be fun. I said that little things like that make me enjoy it.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, so that's good stuff. Yeah. Very good. So now the first collected edition had chapters 0 through 6, right?
That's right.
So now you're starting this one out with a 40-page introductory. Is that going to be the first chapter? Is that going to be a couple chapters in it? How's that going to work?
So, yeah, the second series, similar, will be 5 to 6 issues. I haven't finished scripting all of them, but, it will consist – it will be a series of single issues, much like the first one.
Now, according to the Kickstarter, and I don't know how much you want to go into this, but I found it really interesting, is that when you start to talk about the second series, it picks up right from where the first series left off, which is one of the reasons I don't want to go too deep into the first series.
Yeah, so if you recall, there was a one-page epilogue at the end of the first graph or collector trade, and that sort of the story develops from there.
Mm-hmm. And I'll say what's on the Kickstarter because I think that's public knowledge. But it says on here, it says, they're called upon to aid the very foe they had spent most of their lives fighting against. That's which, right. Of course, makes me wonder, like, whoa, wait a second here. You know, that's a very Trek thing, though, I have to say, is when you have to go and help your enemy, or, you know, you get a Klingon on the bridge of the Enterprise or something like that. But see, that's science fiction to me. That's very forward thinking. I mean, you know, places you don't expect to go, you end up going. So that was something I liked when I read that about it. Of course, I've backed the Kickstarter as well, and I'm just looking so forward to when this is going to come.
No, thank you. Thank you again for backing it. But yeah, it's definitely something I wanted to explore more of. You know, the conflict had just ended at the conclusion of the first series. And before they even find their footing or you know, sort out the after the fallout following that, you know, this new situation arises where they have to sort of get themselves ready in a hurry and just go on an impulse, you know. And there will be challenges along the way. But it will be interesting, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, based on the first book, I'm just sure the second one's going to be great fun, great reading. I'm just going to dive into it, and I'll be gone for about an hour or two as I, you know, think about it. Like I said, what good science fiction makes me think, and that's what the first book did for me. I had to sit and think about, wait a second, what does that mean? And before I go racing on to the next page, you know, turn the page, I go, wait a second, what does that mean? As far as that goes. And I love that. I always tell the story when I used to watch Deep Space Nine, mm-hmm. the show would end and I'd be sitting there and the next show would come on and I wouldn't even notice it was on. I'd be so busy thinking about the current episode. Now about 15 minutes later, I go, wait a second, there's another show on. I was so lost in thought. And that's why I was with your book. I'd get to a chapter in and I go, wait a second, I got to think about this before I move on. You know,
yeah, I mean, currently there are certain aspects, you know, you have to read it carefully. It's not sort of for those, it's not a book you can really skim through very quickly, because if you do miss some bits, you may kind of wonder, hey, where is this going? But if you do sort of pay attention and think about it a little bit, hopefully, you know, as you said, there might be a surprise or two.
Now, this is one of your different kinds of writing. One of the things I enjoy about your writing is that you do different stuff. You know, Mapmaker is very different from Exilium, this is different from Trail. Yep. Every one of them is a different kind of writing. Is that, as a writer, is that the kind of thing you're aiming for, to do something different and to take us different places and maybe go take your head in a different place?
Definitely. I enjoy various genres. My very first series was Trail, and that came up with that following discovering a little known legend recorded by Marco Polo when he was traversing through Persia relating to the biblical three kings. And I sort of started researching, you know, having interest in history apart from science fiction. I've studied Egyptology in the past, so history for me has always been a passion. So, you know, researching that, came across some really interesting bits that are kind of weaved into a story. But then on other fronts, you know, like you said, Mapmaker is quite different. It's targeting a different audience. That's probably based more on, you know, my early days as a comic reader of the books like Asterix, Tintin, Lucky Luke, more in that sort of genre or type of humor. And general feel. And then you have some of my historical graphic novels. There's 1566 AD, based on a historical event in my native Croatia, where I'm originally from, which was a huge battle and that had huge implications in the war against the Ottoman Empire and the European forces. And then, you know, following, you know, my interest in Egypt and having conducted field work there, digging up tombs and stuff, there is one particular area of Egypt that I'm particularly fascinated with, and that was actually going to be subject of my dissertation for my PhD. Now I'm turning that into a two-volume graphic novel series, which I think will be quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. So
I'm not sort of bound by one genre. I'm certainly looking to explore various different genres for different demographic, different audiences.
That's going to be great fun because, you know, I've read some of them and I really enjoyed. Trail is the one I haven't gotten to,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to get to that. It's one of the things I think the one that I signed up for. Let me make sure. Yeah, there's one's called a digital bundle. You get 18 comics, and that includes Trail in there. So I'm really looking forward to seeing those because I get a chance to read that as well as have copies of the other ones.
Yeah, there'll be a bit to read there. There's a few different books. Yep.
That'll be good. I'm looking forward to that. Now, getting back to Exilium a little bit, as far as like the artwork and, I enjoyed the artwork because it has much more of a science fiction feel to it and the characters and stuff like that. I'm always kind of, you know, you talked about the fact you wanted to do something that was a little different as far as having them come from Brazil. Mm-hmm. As far as what they look like, did you have... When you got the... Let's start with how you got the artist. How did you find the artist to do this?
So I looked around. Basically, when I look for an artist for a series, I have a particular style in mind. So I look for, you know, artists through portfolios and previous body of work. And I just happened to have come across Salo, who's based in Chile. He's done some other sci-fi work in the past, and I just thought his style would suit this book quite well. I've seen him do some sci-fi stuff before, and I think he's got quite a good knack for doing science fiction, for sure. Obviously, he's also an artist of Wretches, which is with Scout Comics, which is another great title.
Mm-hmm. Now, as far as the looks of the characters, did you go to him and say, this is what I would like the character to look like? Did you kind of collaborate on that? How did you get like Ken? What does Ken look like? Is he looking like somebody you know? Is he based on a somebody in your imagination? How did those characters come?
So in some of my series, we try and base them on particular people in terms of the look. But in case of Exilium, it was more of a sort of I provided a description to Salo in terms of, you know, age, height, what their ethnic background is, and we kind of went through a few tweaks and arrived where we're at today.
Mm-hmm. Because some of them are you know, the various characters in there are all different. Even Taru's people look different one from another. Some of them will have like markings on their face and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, in case of Buck, for example, he's got a big, like, a birthmark across his face, which just tried to differentiate him from Taru in some way because he's a recurring character. But, obviously, that they do vary a little bit, just like humans do.
Yeah, now we talked a little bit about the technology and stuff like that. When you put the technology in the story, did you have like a level of technology you were thinking of? I mean, as because you know you've got space stations and you've got spaceships and things like that. Where did the technology come from, and what level did you want to keep these guys at so that it's true to the story?
Sure. So, I mean, this is probably, you know, 100 years from now. I didn't particularly set it in a particular year. But, you know, I looked at latest theories on propulsion and things like that. What is really realistic in terms of achieving that faster than light travel? You know, I opted for a gravity wave engine, you know, riding a gravity wave to get from point A to point B rather than just, you know, disappear in a flash of light, like some of those FTL drive staples of other series. So I do try and sort of do some research and see what would fit this series and, put a little bit of thought into it. Now, when it comes to the stations, like the Exilium station, that's obviously based on the Dyson Sphere. And in fact, it was the recently theorized structure around this distant star that gave me an idea for that. I'm not sure if you recall, in the last few years, there's been some debate about a particular star system, KIC, and there's a long number after it, where the light of the star is constantly dimming and then sort of flickering, and they weren't sure why that is. So one of the theories put forward was that there may be, in fact, a structure, megastructure around the star causing that variation in light from the star. So, you know, what the actual situation is, no one knows. But, yeah, so I've based that and put the Dyson sphere around there, and this is where the ultimate destination for some of these humans was.
Mm-hmm. Really, really cool. So I love the science in it. So many times in, like, Star Trek and other shows, I would learn science from what was going on. And that was one of the things I enjoyed about this book too. There was a lot of science involved, and it wasn't that it was out of reach. It was, you made it very accessible and very understandable, which I really liked.
Oh, good. Good to hear.
Yeah. There was, I have to say though, one of the great things, and I always don't I don't get why people say this about science fiction. It can't have any humor involved, but you don't do that. You have some great humor, and there's a line in one of them where Nia is actually saying to, like, this computer intelligence, she says, hold on to your photons. And it takes a little while, but all of a sudden the computer thinks, oh, that was a joke. He goes, which made me laugh. I said, you know, the best part was it didn't happen immediately. He had to think about it for a little while. For a couple panels, he doesn't see it. Then finally he goes, oh, that was a joke. I the delay made me laugh. I thought that was, the timing was great with that. You know, computers that interact with us shouldn't always get humanisms, in my mind. And so to see that and see it handled that way, I thought was really cool.
Oh, good. I'm glad that landed. Yeah, I mean, I tried to infuse a little bit of humor. I mean, in our everyday lives, you need a bit of humor, you know, and I couldn't imagine, you know, writing a series where it was too serious, too gritty. And I'm not a fan of science fiction that's overly gritty and overly serious. And obviously, I mean, there are serious themes tackled in Exilium. But, you know, when you have your camaraderie among the three lifelong friends, you would expect, you know, a bit of, you know, joking around and some humor as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the people in charge? Like, because, you know, there's always an interesting thing in science fiction. Of course, Star Trek has the great thing where all the admirals are crazy, basically. And yeah. You've got some of the people in charge are not necessarily the most trustworthy, shall we say. And I got a huge kick out of that. I always am intrigued when people go up the ladder. Somehow they seem to – they're not quite as I don't know how to say it. They seem to lose something the more that they move up in the rank. They become an admiral somehow. You don't quite think the way that everybody else does, and that's not necessarily a good thing.
Yeah.
How did you handle that when it comes to people who are in charge and stuff like that? Because just like the aliens and stuff, they're very different from each other, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, when you're in charge and you're trying to hold on to your people and keep them sort of keep that hope alive, you know, there may be an aspect of, you know, trying to suppress certain information or keep it a bit more optimistic than the situation actually is. So it may have played a role in kind of shaping how those characters are perceived as well. Obviously, they have the best interest of humankind and alien kind residing on Earth in mind and preserving the life on Earth. So it's sort of do whatever is necessary to keep things together and put up a front as strong as possible. So, yeah, I mean, that could be a and that may sort of, yeah, guide sort of be a factor in developing that the character and why, you know, they may not immediately be seen as trustworthy in some cases, or perhaps they were withholding things, or certainly didn't go for, yeah, some of that crazy aspect, like as you mentioned in Star Trek, where the admiral just lose the plot.
Now, one of the things you touched a little bit on, something I was interested in too, was that, you know, as diverse as humanity has become, when something external like Taru's people come, it somehow old feelings seem to stir. You know, here comes a race that it doesn't look necessarily as human as some people might like. And so there's resistance to that. I find that really interesting, that even as humanity matures and grows, still things happen to that challenge us, and we don't necessarily always respond, you know, in the most enlightened way. That was an interesting thing to see in the book.
Yeah, that's right. As I mentioned previously, you know, there is that fear factor that drives the motives of many of the people. The reports of abductions and experiments and etc. Is certainly cause to fear them. And when they come here looking for help, it's a response by some, you know, flat out no. You've caused us some pain, done this and that, and, you know, welcome here type thing. Which, you know, I don't think it's unrealistic, you know, given that everyone's different, perceives some of the threats differently. There's definitely, you know, two factions that formed, some that wanted to help them out, others that increasingly got vocal about their opposition of that. So, you know, eventually little by little developed into a conflict.
Mm-hmm. Which is interesting to see. Like I said, you know, on some levels, some people think that Star Trek's unrealistic because there's no conflict. You know, everybody in Starfleet gets along no matter what they look like or who they are. But yours actually gets a little more based on human reaction to things, which I still find interesting. I sometimes with Star Trek and other things, when they're too advanced, it's a little hard to relate to it, let's say. But with your book, they're still human. Even though the diversity has been accepted and there's a lot of advancing that's happened, they still are human beings and relatable, which I thought was a real accomplishment of your writing in the book and stuff like that, was that even as advanced as we might get, we'll still be human, which I liked about that.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, certain aspects of that what defines as humans, I think it'll be difficult to change. You know, there's certain things that, you know, people will still fear and find a threat. And, you know, they will react differently to different situations, which is exactly what happened in Exilium. And, and whether it's, you know, placed in current timeline or 100 years from now, I don't think there will be too different, you know. Certain things are difficult to change, you know, and the overall sort of theme was that I took was that, you know, we as humans can often be our own worst enemy. So, and that's really how a lot of the storyline developed, you know, without giving away too much.
Yeah, my biggest problem in talking with this book is I want to get into some of the details, because as the story progresses, I was just gripped. I couldn't figure what they were going to do next and what was going to happen next, which I love. I mean, most stories I'll go along and I can kind of see things coming a mile away with some stuff. And science fiction, like Star Wars and stuff, sometimes I just kind of sit there and go, yeah. I was in a movie theater one time and something happened that didn't make sense and I yelled it out and the people around me laughed. Because I wasn't the only one that felt that way. But your book, the great thing about your writing and about Exilium is that it proceeds thoughtfully. Like I said, it happens, and if we engage in it and we think about it as it's happening, I think you get so much more out of it than you just kind of quick page turning. And yeah. I like a good read like that. And this is one of the things about Exilium that really got me, was that I had to slow down. I had to say, wait a second. Like I said, in between chapters, I would stop and think about it. I said, I've got to think about this. There's something coming that I want to be aware of when it happens. And I wish there was more writing like that, to be honest with you. Sometimes I can flip through a comic in like 5 minutes sometimes.
Yeah, look, there are some comics saying that I can flip through them quite quickly. Exilium was written across several years, so I've had quite a bit of time to consider the implication of what's happened and how it will affect the events to come. And I really wanted to put some thought into it. I'm definitely not the writer who can sit down and knock out a script for an issue in a couple of sittings. You know, it takes me a little bit of time because I try and put some thought into it. So my process tends to be a little bit lengthy when it comes to writing.
That's a good thing, though. I mean, there are some people who can turn scripts around, you know. Well, like, you know, as much as I admire Jeff Johns, who writes many good, one of my favorite comics, he can turn a script around like in a week, usually. And that he's one of the longer ones as in comic writing. Yeah. I've seen some people, it's like in a day or two, they can knock out a whole comic. And I'm always like, and I read the book and I go, yeah, I can see why. You know,
and yeah, I mean, the amount of research, you know, I put into some of my books, particularly the historical ones, you know, where I consult dozens of books, research papers, etc. I mean, the amount of research is staggering. So, you know, it's something definitely can't be written in a week or even a month. Or and similarly with Exilium, you know, I've looked at what can I use, you know, real life events, discoveries to kind of infuse that into the story. And I'm doing the same with the Exilium spin-off series. I found that an interesting angle to exploit base the spin-off series around, which I think will be pretty cool.
Do you have a name for that yet, or is that something you want to hold back until the time comes?
The proposed name is Exilium Vanguard.
Oh, is that then? I don't know. I don't want to ask too many questions because I don't want to spoil stuff, but it sounds like an alien race or something.
So currently, that's our working title. But yeah, I'm very excited about that one, actually. Yeah.
Are you going to Kickstarter that one as well?
Well, we'll see. You know, I might even do some combined Kickstarters down the track. I'll see how it goes. For next year, I plan to have probably at least 3 Kickstarters, some of them for my graphic novels, and then Exilium current series. I might combine issues 2 and 3, and then the new series. Yeah, it may well be its own. So, we'll see. We'll see how things turn out next year for sure.
Well, you know, I have to say, I really enjoyed the book, and I really, I'm so looking forward to the next one. That's why as soon as I saw it was out there, I had to, I quick jumped on and supported it. And that's why I tried to reach out to you to be able to talk with you about this. And again, if you're listening to this and you notice we're not talking too much in depth about the story, it's because it's one of those stories. If you pull one part out, it reveals stuff that happens later on that I don't want to spoil. I think you need to read it like I did. Dive into it, enjoy it. If you need to take a break while you're doing something, think about stuff, do that, because I think you'll get more out of it when you do that. And I love a book like that, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I'm the same. And no, thank you for the kind comments. I'm glad to be talking to someone who has taken the time to actually appreciate the story and see what I was trying to do with it.
Oh, so good. So enjoyable. I just, you know, I want so badly to spoil everything but I can't ruin somebody else's experience. I want them to enjoy it like I did and dive in, swim around in there and really get to find out what all the levels that are in the story. Cause you know, you said it took a long time to put this good stuff together and you can tell that. And that's something that I want everybody to get to experience for themselves, is to understand these things and to spend some time with that, which is like, as I keep saying, it's a rare thing in comics these days.
No, thank you.
The one thing that I was really glad, and I'm not saying this to detract anybody from doing it, I got to read it all in one time. I got to sit and start from one to the other. I'm going to be interested to see what the difference is in my experience, because now I'm going to get to read the individual chapters as they become available. So I'm really going to be fascinated to see how I do that. What I'm probably going to end up doing is, when a new chapter comes out, I'm going to go back and reread the other one, so I'm ready for the new chapter and get into it. So I think that'll be a way to do it.
Yeah, it could be. Obviously, it's a different experience reading it in chapters or issues than digesting in one sitting. So, the refresher could certainly help, with subsequent issues.
Oh, as far as your, you know, you went through Exilium, the 0 through 6, and now you're doing the second time around. Is there a difference as how you're approaching it now? Is it taking longer? Is it taking less time now that you've gotten and done a lot of the research and stuff? What's different as far as your writing on the second volume of this?
I think it might not take me as long, because the characters are established, the universe is established to a large degree. But certainly introducing the theme of the new series, it will take a little bit of time as well, because it's, again, I'm trying to do something that's not necessarily immediately conventional or just a 5-minute read, you know. So those kind of stories do take me a little bit to set up and consider the impacts of various plot points down the track as well. So I go through a lot of edits in my scripts, dialogue as well. So it will still be a lengthy process. Although, I mean, we're looking at probably producing about 3 issues per year.
Okay, well, it'll be worth the wait, believe me. I can't wait for it to come. You know, some stuff is, I don't know why people sit there, something really good, and they say they complain that it takes too long. I said, I'll be ready when it's here. You know, if it's so good, I'm willing to wait until it comes out. So that's what I am with your book. I am going to be very patient. I'll be happy to wait until it's good and ready, because I know it's going to be worth the wait.
Yeah, good to hear. You know, thank you for the kind words.
Now, one of the things I wanted to mention for sure is I've talked often about the collected edition. One of the things you can get as a benefit, you can order this very graphic novel that I have in my hands, which I really, like I said, I keep saying how much I enjoyed it. It was wonderful. And you can order this as part of pledging as your support in the Kickstarter, which I really like. And I would recommend, if you get a chance to do that, get the book. If you want, or the digital versions as well. I think that any of the way that you can read these first issues, I like the collected one though, because like I said, you get those little extra goodies in there that I really liked, the character designs and you have some stuff from that. You write a column in there that's really good, and there's all kinds of wonderful things in there. So if you have a choice, my personal preference would be to get the collected edition, just because there's all that extra stuff that's going to be so worth it. So that's why now, as we're talking, you have passed the $5,000. Now, Chris, I'm talking in American dollars. I think that's what it shows up in front of me. I think is that it. I think it's converted into American dollars instead of Australian, because it says your goal was $2,591, which I don't think anybody would pick out of the hat. So that's probably translated from. Do you remember what it was in Australian dollars you were originally going
yep,
for?
So 3,500 Australian, and in Australian, it's currently sitting at 8,001.
Okay. Well, I'm looking at it right now. It says in American dollars, $5,924, which is still a good lot of money, as far as I'm concerned. So I'm real pleased with that, and I'm so glad it's doing so well. I hope by the time this posts and you're getting close to the end, it's even farther along, because you've got stretch goals in here that go. Let's see. Let's see. You've got goals for 5,500, which you've passed, and 6,500. I think that's in Australian dollars. I think you've already passed that. In fact, the $7,500, as far as Australian goes, yep. You got. So now you got to get to 10,000. That's where we got to get to 10,000 in Australia.
That's our ultimate goal. Yep.
Now you get to that point, and hopefully, if you've already gotten, then you have to excuse me. I'm excited about it. There's a free 10x13 bifold poster for all the physical backers, and it contains the original wraparound cover for issue number 6, which I really loved. I thought that was a wonderful bit of drawing, stuff like that. So that's all in there and good. And you can get episode 0 for the first time in print as a standalone comic.
Yeah, that's right.
That's cool. See, that's in that trade that I keep talking about. That's in there as well. So again, I'd trade if it was me, but you may want something different.
Yeah.
So you're talking about, you're saying you might do 3 issues a year is what you're expecting.
Yeah, roughly, you know, taking into account, you know, my schedule and the artist's schedule, I think that's probably a more of a realistic schedule for sure. So hopefully by early 2021, we should wrap up this current second series.
Oh, really? Wow. So when is the 40-page issue due to come out?
So the issue is complete. It's getting lettered now. About half of it is already actually lettered. So before the end of the campaign, we will have it fully completed and sent to the printer.
Wow. Okay. When might we see the editions of that actually hit us?
You mean when we will actually fulfill?
Yes, for this issue, yeah.
Yeah, so digital ones will go out as soon as all the Kickstarter process is complete. The payments and all that, the digital one will go out immediately. And then the print, it will go to the print immediately and start shipping straight away. So there should be minimal delay.
Oh, boy, I can't wait for Tuesday then, because I'm ready to read that first issue. I can't wait for that. So, again, it's titled on here, it's called Exilium, the hit sci-fi series returns for seasons truly. I blew that all to shreds when I said it was science fiction instead of sci-fi, but that's all right.
I have to use, short, because you're the character to limit in Twitter and everywhere else. I have to settle for sci-fi.
That's right. Well, you can only get so much in the title and stuff like that, but I would still say science fiction, but you know what? Sci-fi works too. I think that's going to be great. So I think that, if you're just listening to this now, you've got limited time. So I would get the Kickstarter and look for Exilium, and it's Exilium is the way that it's spelled. And as I said, the hit sci-fi series returns for season two. And you find that on a Kickstarter, and be sure to get in there before Tuesday at 3 a.m. Eastern time, which is a little different where you are, Ben. So that's
right. It will be our Tuesday afternoon.
Okay. But believe me, you need to get in here and get this stuff. Get the trade, as I always keep saying. But there's so many good things to get with it. And I just think it's going to be so worth the wait and to be able to get them. You've got, cover collectors levels, custom sketch covers, commissions you can order, advertise your next product or project with one of them, as well as other things. So you've got lots of good levels out there, which I always think is a good sign of a great Kickstarter when you've got all these good things out there that you can do and support. So again, you've only got until Tuesday morning in the Eastern time zone of the U.S., and I would say, now's the time to get in there and don't wait until Tuesday morning hits. Now's the time to get out there and get in there and push this over the $10,000 Australian limit so that these good things will be available to all of us. So it's good. So let's talk about what else is coming that we should be aware of. What other projects are you working on that we should know about?
Sure. So I currently have an all-ages title, and I probably would use the term sci-fi more for this particular one, sci-fi action called Temporal Mechanic, with the mecha part of mechanic being in capitals, bit of a double entendre there. It sort of follows a girl and her grandfather who run a temporal roadside assistance, where they, in fact, help time machines that are stranded in the past pull them back out. So it's a lot of fun. I sent out actually a preview to our Kickstarter supporters. So they're the first ones to have had a look, the opening act, which is 10 pages. So that will be coming soon, towards end of this year, early next year. And then we have, I'm still working on my two historical graphic novels, 1566 and Ahmose, the Egyptian, ancient Egyptian graphic novel. And then there is another sci-fi/science fiction. I'm not sure what term I would use that for that particular one, called Fisherman, which is a little bit of influenced by classics like Moby Dick and Old Man in the Sea, but in space. But not dealing with any space whales or anything like that. But a similar sort of theme of that run through those two books. And that one is I'm very excited about, actually, as well.
That's really cool, because another thing about in the trade, you get in the next to last page, you get pictures, the covers of all these good things are all in there, which is I can't wait to see it. Is Fisherman, do you have an idea when that's going to come out?
We anticipate that one. That one I had to put on a little bit of a back burner. There were just too many projects going on, but I would expect it by end of next year to be out.
Okay. Are you going to Kickstarter that?
Potentially, if I can fit it into the schedule. As I said, the next year I'm looking probably for at least three Kickstarters, and I'd like to fulfill them, before running the next one. So if all lines up, we'll see which ones I'll actually run Kickstarters for.
Okay. And that all leads into the next important thing. Let's say we want to follow your stuff on social media. How do we do that?
Sure. So you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all the same, Ben Slabak. BenSlabak, and also on my website, benslabak.com.
Which is great stuff. I highly recommend it. And like I said, Exilium, if you haven't gotten to it and you're a science fiction fan, you need to jump on board because it's going to be something you're going to really enjoy. And all those other ones, too. Now I'm intrigued by Fisherman. I got to see what that's all about. I got to know all these things. Oh, I can't wait. Okay. Ben, you do wonderful stuff. And all I can say is keep it up, boy. I see your name somewhere. I got to buy the book because it's going to be good stuff. So, just keep up the good stuff as always, and I can't wait to see these good things, and I can't wait for Tuesday now. I'm looking forward to Tuesday. As soon as that email hits me, I'll be after it. Get those things. I'll be dying to see that first chapter. So
hopefully it won't disappoint.
Oh, no. Believe me, I am so looking forward. I'm sure it's going to be great. It's going to be wonderful. So that'll be great. So all I can say is that get to Exilium. The hit sci-fi series returns for season 2. Get the trade, if I can say that one more time, and look forward to all these good things coming. And like I said, if you see Ben's name on a book, I would recommend you get it because you're going to get a good read out of it. So, Ben, just keep at it. I can't wait to see these other good things that are coming. We'll have to talk again when these other things start to come to fruition. But
I'd be happy to. And thank you for making the time and for your support. I really do appreciate it. I don't get to do too many of these because of the time difference involved, so it can be tricky to line up. So thank you for being flexible with it, and really, really appreciate it.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
It's great to welcome to the podcast Rodney Fike from Hasm Productions. And he just completed a successful Kickstarter for Roadkill Rampage, a book we're going to talk about. So how are you doing, Rodney?
I'm doing great. How are you doing today?
Good. It's good to talk with you. You know, normally I talk with people during a Kickstarter, so this is a little different for me. We'll get to kind of look back at your Kickstarter as well as the comic and kind of update people on it. So why don't we start out, and why don't you tell people what Roadkill Rampage is all about?
Okay, we can do that. Roadkill Rampage is the story of a young couple, Ace and Tess, as they take a drive out into the country on a nice sunny day. And while they're out on the road, Ace decides that he's going to play a game of chicken with some of the local wildlife. And when he starts doing this, Tess becomes furious and tries to stop him. She does everything she can to try to stop him. When she's unsuccessful at that, things take a turn for the worse. The animals come back and exact their own form of revenge. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a roadster type horror slash teen kind of on the road type. I almost said movie. but it's a horror comic. It's our first venture at the horror genre, and we're really happy with the results.
Yeah, congratulations as always. I think that it's wonderful when anybody gets a Kickstarter completed and you get the money. I don't know whether the money has hit you yet. It takes a little while. You know, they have to give people a chance. If some people, their card isn't ready when the time comes, they get like a week to do that. And so I think it ended on the 20th, didn't it?
The 21st, yeah.
21st. Okay. So yeah, that's good. So that's good. And was it a 30-day Kickstarter?
Yeah, it was a 30-day Kickstarter, wasn't it, baby? Yes, it was 30 days.
Okay, so that's good. Yeah, because that's usually how they go out. Some people will do like only a week, and I'm going like, man, you barely know what's going, and then suddenly it's over.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like it better that way. There's 40 days and all kinds of stuff. So let's talk about this book for a little bit. I want to talk about your history in indie comics and stuff like that, too, because I think that's interesting. But the way that the Kickstarter page, and it's still up there, Roadkill-Rampage, is you describe the characters. It says Ace is described as hell on wheels. a bad boy hellion with an insatiable need to strike fear and shift gears, which I like. I find that really kind of interesting. You know, one of the things you talk about in the video on the Kickstarter was the fact that you tend to do more family-oriented or all-ages type stuff.
Yes.
And this is something different for you. I mean, talk about the interest in, you know, because I think a good writer can stretch their muscles and do other things. Talk about what it was like to do a horror after doing all ages. Was it freeing? Was it constricting? How did this go for you?
Oh my God, it was very freeing. It was so much fun. I've been doing the peanut pudding and jelly for several years now, and as much as I enjoy doing it, you know, I mean, those are my kids, you know. When you're at a show and you're doing commissions and stuff, very seldom are you doing cute, cuddly things. You're doing superheroes or you're doing zombies or you're doing mech or whatever. And we really got to a point where the all ages stuff was becoming a hard sell. It has its niche, but the niche is limiting. And I was really aching to try my chops at something else. And the story came to me, and we kind of put it on the shelf for a couple of years because we were concentrating on other things. And we pulled it out at a point where we were, you know, breaking and trying to go to a different direction, try something new. And I said, okay, let's try this. Let's try this. And we found an artist to do it, because my thought was, our thought was to try to get involved in several projects and start getting more books on the table at shows. So we have this Cincinnati Comic Creators Club that we created, and all the local artists get together on the second Tuesday of every month, and we go to a bar, and there's a back room that they have reserved for us, and we all sit there and we get a drink and dinner, and you're free to bring whatever you'd like to work on or just come and hang out and do nothing, just vibe off of each other. And that's what we do. And we ran into a guy who we hadn't known previously, and his name is Eamon Hill, the artist on Roadkill Rampage. And his work just really spoke to us. And as we got to know him over the course of a couple of months, we found out that, you know, him and I really have a lot of the same influences, read a lot of the same comic books and Jack Davis and Bernie Wrightson and stuff like that, all the EC comics and all the monster movies, scary movies from the 80s and early 90s and stuff like that was in our wheelhouse. So Tina and I, my wife Tina and I, were talking about it, and she's like, well, why don't you ask him if he'd be interested in doing it? Because we originally had it slated to do with a different artist, but he had a more cartoony style. Mm-hmm. We're like, well, I just don't think this, you know, and the other artist agreed too, that he didn't think that his style was going to be appropriate for it. So we asked Eamon, and he was kind of taken aback by it, because he's a tattoo artist. So he hasn't done much in the genre of comics. He and his wife just produced their first comic, which is Arcana Vaquero, which is on the Hazm website. But he'd only done one issue. And I think when we met him, they had just started that project. So that's when, you know, a few months in, we talked to him about doing Roadkill Rampage. And I was explaining some things to him, and there's a couple of scenes in there that he was a little concerned about. And he asked me how I would plan on handling those. And I said, well, I'm a big fan of Alfred Hitchcock's approach where less is more. I think that the imagination is more powerful than something you could show on screen or in a book. And he's like, I'm in. So, because there's a particularly rough scene in there where he was concerned about how I wanted to do that. Mm-hmm. So once he realized that we both, you know, we're thinking on the same lines as far as the approach goes to the execution of it, he was on board.
Cool. And you guys are local, so you can talk to each other.
Yes. Yes. No, we actually, through the whole process, we'd get together probably once every 6 weeks. And then now that we're on issue two, We plan to touch base at the bare minimum once every other week. And we've both got it down on our schedules. And he told me, you know, whenever you want to talk about something or whatever, he says, just call me. He says, well, we don't have to stick to the 2 week thing. You know, just give me a call and we'll talk about it. He says, cause I'm sure going to call you if I have questions. So. Mm-hmm.
Cool. So, well, that's great that you're local. Cause like the comic that I'm involved with, I'm an editor for an indie comic. And the writer is in Florida. The artist is on the top of a mountain in North Carolina. Oh, the colorist is in the Philippines. And the letterer is in South Carolina. So they've never all been in the same room.
Right.
So it's interesting. It must be something different. They'll be able to just, you know, face to face.
Yeah, that it's funny because I've kind of always worked that way because my first iteration in comics back in the 90s was all my friends from high school. So we were always together and, you know, that ran its course until we all grew up and they all got married and moved away and had families and stuff. And then I've been lucky enough to took a break for a while and came back and did Peanut Pudding and Jelly. And that was all me, you know, art and everything. And then, We had a guest artist come in and do a couple issues of PP&J to free me up to do other things, but he was also local. You can work with people in other cities and other states and countries and stuff. Especially, you know, with the internet, it's easy, but you know, I mean, our letterer and graphic designer, he lives in Philadelphia or outside of Philadelphia. But you know, we talk to him all the time. And he's just an amazing, we were so lucky to find him. He's just the phenomenal work. His name's Dave Lentz and just a great guy, funny guy.
That's great.
Hell of an artist.
Well, that's great. Cause you know, the interesting thing is, you know, it's funny how people in different areas can kind of come together and do this kind of a thing. I'm always fascinated by that because, you know, you live in a big metropolitan area. Sometimes New York people are dealing with people in Los Angeles. All this stuff is going on. And
yes.
You'd think in New York you could find everybody that you'd possibly want to do a comic, but it's
you would
not
think.
Always the case. Yeah, it's not always the case, which I always find interesting. You brought up several things I want to do, but I want to finish up the business with the characters.
Okay.
On the Kickstarter, I talked about Tess. Tess is Ace's girlfriend and girl next door with a heart too big to stomach the roadway slaughtering before her. She didn't anticipate this gore-paved journey on this fateful day.
No, she did not.
Then there's another section under there. The title for her section, by the way, is Riding with the Devil. And then we have Roadkill, and this is the one that kind of entertained me. It says, ready or not, here death comes. Beginning with a humble squirrel just looking for a snack, this unfortunate little fella bites off more than he can chew with Ace. And I don't want to go into the rest of it because I think it'll spoil some stuff. But I got a huge kick that the squirrel is is listed as a character in the book. So I found that real funny. Very different. I know it's. The thing about animals too gets me. There was a book called Animosity that I was reading, and suddenly the animals become conscious and they're able to talk. And I was reading that comic one, and I was looking down at my two dogs that were there, and I looked at them, and I thought, what are they really thinking? You know, because the same thing with your book is it's interesting because the animals. They function. It's not like Bandit in Johnny Quest. They're a lot more advanced, shall we say, the things that they do. They're still animals, but they think and they plot and they plan and they do things, which I find really fascinating. Yeah. Talk about that. I mean, what was it about the animals that, I mean, the characters I really like. I thought the two of them are funny, but the animals are what kind of surprised me. Talk about going that route with animals and doing this, because that was kind of a surprise to me.
Okay. Well, I can tell you the genesis of the story will explain a lot.
Okay.
I have a part-time day job where I deliver and pick up cars from pharmaceutical reps. cars and trucks and vans and Amazon vans and stuff like that. So I'm in Cincinnati, but I go to five surrounding states sometimes for my job. And I was in Columbus one summer afternoon. And if you're familiar with Columbus, Ohio, it is in a state of perpetual construction and construction delays. So it was 300 degrees outside, and it was a Friday evening, and I was stuck in construction's traffic moving about 5 miles an hour. And up on the road, on the shoulder of the road, the right left-hand shoulder of the road, there was this baby raccoon laying there. And I knew he was dead, but when I got up on him, there was no visible sign of trauma. And he looked, he had his back to me, and his fur was just blowing just gently and serene. And I pulled around and I could see his face, and he just looked like he was laying there asleep, and his little paw was extended out. And I was just like, man, you know, where was he going? What was he doing? Who's going to miss him? Who's waiting on him? And all this just started going through my head. And I immediately picked up my cell phone and I started talking into it. And 25 minutes later, I had the rough outline for this issue. But yeah, it's, and I've hit raccoons before, you know, probably 25 years ago. I've hit a deer before. And it's, and it always amazes me that, and you know, my job driving all over the country, I see roadkill every day. And I always, that thought always goes through my head, you know, man, he was just going out to get some sugar, you know, and it's all over. So I we're impeding on their territory, and, you know, we're the ones in their neighborhoods. And, I've always thought of things, you know, from that perspective, where was he going? What was he doing? And it's just, you know, I've never had pets until recently. We've got some cats, and I've got this little white cat, and his name is Sherman. And he's just my whole world. He is just something else. And my wife's mother brought him home from the pound, and he just kept reaching out to her when she walked past him. And she had no intention of getting this little kitten. She was there looking for the other cat. That was missing. And she brought this little thing home, and he was sick, and he had stuff wrong with his eyes, and he wasn't any bigger than the palm of my hand, and just took to him. And then he just took to me, and he's just my right hand man now. I have this ever building love for, I mean, I've always loved animals, but I've never had pets. I was never allowed to have pets growing up. But yeah, I don't know. I kind of always think of things from the animals' perspectives a lot.
I don't blame you, because we have, where I live in Florida, we have three ducks that I take care of. In fact, awesome. Before I started recording this, I was out feeding, you know, taking the stuff in at night, because I don't want speaking of raccoons, I don't want them to get them. We lost one.
Yeah.
When we first got them, because we think the raccoons got to them, although we weren't watching at the time, so we don't know. But, you know, we have three rescue dogs, two parakeets. It's like a menagerie around here. But I like it that way. I prefer to have them. But I have to say, the squirrel reminded me of two things. I don't know if you've ever seen the Geico commercial where this squirrel is out in the road, and when the car kind of veers off the road because rather than hit them, it goes off the thing, and the two squirrels high-five each other, which I got a kick of. And,
yeah, he'll be back.
Oh.
And it's so funny, because when I was writing issue two, I was going one way, and then through the course of rewrites and conversations, because I had written and thumbnailed out 17 pages for issue two, and we decided to go a different direction. So I almost forgot what I was doing with this character, with the squirrel. But yeah, he's coming back, and he kind of plays, I don't want to say a pivotal role, but he's definitely, he'll be back.
Okay. Now, you're touching on something I wanted to bring up, though, because one of the things I was reading about, you intended this to be a one-shot.
Yes.
But when you guys started to talk about this, you realized there was a lot more you could do with it. So now it's going to be like a four-issue series? Is that what's going to be?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it just kept growing. I mean, I had an ideas, and it continues to grow still. I was on a podcast with a gentleman out of Columbus, Ohio, and he did, his name is Mike Watson, and he does a chat draw where we get on and we chat and we discuss, well, we were discussing the Kickstarter and discussing the character Ace, and he drew Ace while we were talking. Mm-hmm. And you having read the book, you know what happens. Mm-hmm. And I started getting these ideas about that character. And they were so vivid. And I mean, like, I was laying in bed and I could not sleep. I didn't have to write it down because it was so tangible in my mind. And when I finally fell asleep, I dreamt the sequence exactly from start to finish, how it had come to me. And I wrote it down and I'm like, this changes everything. Just from being on a podcast and having a conversation, because Mike is really enamored with Ace and didn't know anything about him. And he was just really enamored. And just from an hour and a half of talking about him, my mind has just went nuts. And I'm like, okay, well, this changes the course of the back half of the series. So, okay, but I like it. Mm-hmm. I was telling Amon about it. And he just looked at me with his mouth kind of hanging up. And he's like, dude. And I was like, what? He goes, man, dude. I was like, is that a good dude? He goes, yes, that's a good dude.
Well, see, now I've got to ask, though, as far as the characters go, did you pattern them after people you know? Are they creations of your imagination, or is it a combination of both? How did you come up with the characters?
Well, it's funny. Ace is Eamon took him from a former boyfriend of his big sister that she had in high school, mm-hmm. that used to come to the front porch and knock on the door, and Eamon couldn't stand him, and he stank of cigarettes, and he just wasn't a pleasant person. And, you know, once his sister figured out, you know, the kind of person he was, she got away from him. But that's basically who he based that character on. Hmm. And for me, creating the character, he's an amalgamation of my ex-stepfather, the very few memories I have of my father, and just asshole men that I've encountered and known through my life. Being raised by my mom, there was a lot of people, a lot of men of ill repute through her life. And as a kid, you know, those images and stuff were very impactful. And I think consciously I was not thinking of that, but definitely subconsciously there are things when I go back and I read that first issue, I'm like, ooh, that actually happened. Ooh, I remember that. Ooh, I was in the back seat when that happened. Ooh. So, yeah. And Tess is pretty much, she's kind of my mom, you know, she was book smart, or no, I'm saying she was street smart, but she wasn't book smart. And she was kind of forced out of the house at a young age, and was looking for love. And the first person that she thought loved her, you know, got her pregnant. Mm. And so she was forced to go out of her home and marry this person. And it just did not work out for her. So she spent, but she was a tough woman. Mm-hmm. And, but she went from a little girl, a little innocent girl looking for love, to being beaten and bruised and battered. And, but it formed and shaped who she would become, mm-hmm. and made her tougher. So yeah, there's a lot of my mom in her.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay, so that'll be interesting, but we'll see some character development, I'm sure.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
As people go along. So it's kind of funny. One of the things about the book that I'm always interested in, I think black and white always lends itself to horror.
Yes.
But I like to ask, and I don't ask people why they chose color, but I don't know why I always do it with black and white. Did you want to do black and white? Was it financial concerns, or were you interested in the horror aspect of it? Was it a combination of both? Why go black and white?
You know, I just think that that's just how it talked to me. And Eamon's work, his book that he does with his wife, and you can get that on the Hazm website. It's all wash, it's ink wash, but it's in color. And I saw, you know, that book, the progression of that book, and I saw all the black and white ink washes before he added color to them. And I was just like, dude, let's just, and I think we both kind of jointly agreed. And obviously, you know, yeah, black and white's cheaper, but that played no role in it because, you know, we've been doing colored comic books for 10 years. But I mean, if the financial thing played any role in it, it was very minimal. I think once he started sketching the characters and everything, in my mind, it was just a black and white book. So that's just how it progressed, and that's what it is.
Now you've got a color cover on the first issue. That's going to continue for all four?
Yes. Yes. And actually, Eamon, he's working on issue two of his book. He was working on issue two of his book while I was writing issue two of Roadkill Rampage. And he painted the cover for the second issue. And oh my God, it is absolutely gorgeous. He has just grown leaps and bounds in two issues. And I'm like, yeah. Okay, what's the cover of issue two of Roadkill Rampage going to look like now? Because that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So, wow, yeah.
That's great. It's so cool that you guys are local, because that's so rare to find. I mean, and those kinds of things. You know, in the old days, I guess that was the only way you really could do it. But now it's unusual.
Yeah. Yeah. And if I had to choose, I would choose to work local because I like to get together. My wife, Tina, always bangs on me. You don't need to find somebody in the same city. You can find. Yeah, I understand that. I get that. But I like getting together with people and vibing, you know. I don't think if Eamon and I were in different cities, I don't think this book would be near as good as it is. Because we both get together and, you know, we go to a Starbucks or we go to a Panera and we spend 3 or 4 hours sitting there going over stuff and, no, this is wrong here, and let's do it this way. And then he'll say, okay, well, what about this? I did this way, and you had it this way, but I changed it, and here's why. And I'm like, oh, well, like, this works much better. That's great. Good job. You know, I mean, we really – it's a give and take, and we feed off of each other. So you don't get that. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I guess you can on the phone and Skyping or whatever, but I don't know. I just prefer in person.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's that extra level of communication that happens when you're in the same location. It's different than, you know, you can do it on Skype and stuff like that, but it just isn't the same.
I agree.
So, okay, let's talk a little bit. Now, well, before we get to that, I want to – how do people get Roadkill Rampage? Let's say you didn't get a chance to participate in the Kickstarter, but you'd like to get the issues. You've got your website is hazm.com, right?
Yes. Yes.
Is that where you get them?
Yes, they will be available on the website. I believe she just sent everything off to the printer last night. Is that right, maybe, or was it Sunday night? Yeah, Sunday night, everything went off to the printer. So all the things for the rewards and everything, that's all been sent off. So, yeah, additional, if you didn't get on at the Kickstarter, the books will be available on the website here very soon.
Are you going to Comixology or any other digital platforms?
Comixology, where is it at, baby? Is it going to be available digitally?
Spinwiz.
It's going to be available on Spinwiz.
Okay. So that's something to look forward to do that too. Because honestly, I have a stack of books as tall as me that I haven't gotten to read yet. And so I'm starting to get digital ones. I can do that. If I'm sitting waiting for something, I can pull them up on my phone and read them, which I'm starting to do more of. I know some people just scream at me when I tell them that. But
I'm with you because I tell you, every night when I gotta go to bed because I'm driving the next day, I'll lay in bed and I'll pull up Marvel Unlimited and I'll read an issue of Spider-Man. I stopped reading Spider-Man years and years ago, so I've been catching up on Spider-Man, and that's the only book that I read. And I've been reading it now for about 4 months, and I'm almost at issue 700, and I've bought and sold my collection of comics 3 times over the past 30 years. And when I sold it the first time, I had probably 50 plus long boxes and probably 20 short boxes. And it's just, it is so much. You know, and I love comics. You know, I love holding the comics in my hand, but the older I get, the worse my back gets. You know, I kind of dig pulling them up on the phone. And I did not like digital comics when that became a thing 10 years ago. And but now it's like, well, I've got a whole collection right here on the phone. And it doesn't weigh 7,000 pounds.
That's true. The only thing it does take up digital space.
Yes.
You got to be sure you got lots of that.
Exactly.
That's what you got to do. Now, you've brought up another subject that I wanted to get into, and that was your history working in indie comics. Yes. Indie comics creators, to have somebody like you that's been around this long, is quite a wonderful accomplishment because I see indie comics creators kind of come and go. Yes. And so for you to have been around this long, I think that's something really great.
I have come and I have gone.
Oh, you have. So you've done it too. Okay.
Well, see, I've come again. I'm back again.
Okay. Well, that's good. So the question I have for you is, how different now is it to be an indie creator than, let's say, when the first time you were involved with it? What kind of changes stand out to you the most?
Well, at the risk of squirreling myself, and squirrel is a word that we throw out. We do a Thursday night throwdown and a Friday night draw. Sean Forney and myself, every Thursday night at 8 p.m. we get on and we do live draws, and we don't discuss political or religion or anything like that. And if we start jumping down a rabbit hole, somebody will yell squirrel. So I am going to not try to do that, but when we were doing comics in the 90s, it was a different world. And if you weren't not any good, people would tell you you weren't any good. Vehemently. you sound like you've been around for quite a while, so you probably know what I'm talking about. It was a much harsher environment. And to go into Artist Alley and it was a completely different world. So we were thicker skinned, but we were 22 years old and we were young men with dreams and couldn't be told that we couldn't do it. And we made every mistake you could possibly make because there was no internet. There was nothing like that. There were the old guys at the comic shop that you could go and talk to. And they kind of had some of them might have had a slight working knowledge of what to do or how to do it, but they weren't, it was like back then it was like they had the missile codes and they weren't going to give you the information because, and that's just the way it was. So we had to go and we had to figure it all out. But the big difference for me now is, people handle people with kid gloves, because they're afraid to offend somebody. And everybody's nice and everybody's happy, which is great. But people that need tutoring and mentoring and need to be led along and fed they're not having that provided for them because they're being placated. And consequently, you have a lot of really bad product out there. So for me, I see that at every show, and it's I've got a few friends left from the 90s when we were doing it, and I cherish seeing them at shows because we can stand there and just cap on each other, you know, till the end of time, and we laugh and have a good time, and you know, and it's all in good fun, and we don't get, you know, our feelings hurt, or, you know, it's just a good, it's just fun, you know, and that nowadays everybody's so worried about making everybody nod and smile, you know? So for me, that's the biggest difference between now and then. Obviously the computers kind of really changed the landscape. So yeah, that's the biggest difference for me, that glaring difference for me.
Because, you know, in previous years, people would draw on you know, wood, not wood, but like paper. You had the framings that you would draw them on. Yes. So that you give them to the printer,
right,
and stuff. And now, like you're saying, yeah, your artist, he actually does it. How's he do it? If I got it backwards, he's drawing first and then putting.
What he does is, well, in issue two, he's completely penciling digitally. Issue one he did digitally as well, but he prints out the pages in blue line and he inks them and does the gray wash organically. So yeah, there are no original penciled pages.
Yeah. See, if somebody's an artist, they do it the quote unquote old way, they can sell the pages they've drawn.
Yes.
And you know, you can't do that now. You could print it out, but, you know, what's the difference? You could print another 100 of them if you wanted.
Right.
You know, so there's nothing special or unique about that. But I always tell artists who still do things by hand as opposed to by computer that they have a leg up because they can make some extra money if they decide they don't really need the pages anymore and they need a little more money, rather. They'll sell the pages and they'll, you know, make some pretty good money off of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Kids nowadays don't. That's not part of their world, so it's not something that they think about.
Yeah, which is funny. I always find that entertaining.
Yes.
How different it is. Now, I do want to talk a little bit more about the Kickstarter. How did it go for you? I mean, just so people who are listening or maybe considering going Kickstarter, obviously you requested, let me take a look here at the thing. You were looking for $1,000, I think it was, right?
Yes. Just
and you ended up getting $2,939, which is, you know, tremendous. That's great. Then you got 101 backers. How did it go for you? Was, you know, they usually say Kickstarters start out strong and then there's a lull and then things pick up towards the end again. You said there was 30 days. How did it go? Did it go that way for you or was it different?
No, I think that was pretty much how it went for us. We funded in 44 hours and we were just really flabbergasted by that. And it went pretty good for probably a week, and then it slowed down for probably 2 weeks. And we kept going in and adding things and adding bells and whistles and this and that and the other, and it wouldn't move and it wouldn't move and it wouldn't move. And we were asking our friends, what are we doing wrong? And everybody's like, no, you're doing fine. This is just the life of Kickstarter. And, you know, in the last week it really started moving, and the last week it started moving. And yeah, I mean, it pretty much went how the people that we were consulting with told us it was going to go. So yeah, it started off gangbusters, funded in 44 hours, went really, really strong for the next week, tapered off really, really hard for about 2 weeks. And then at the last week, it started moving again.
Yeah, that I call it the daily heart attack.
Yes. You know,
you turn it on, nothing's happened. And
the daily, what are we doing wrong attack?
Because <Yeah. because, you know, it's, you know, you can't help it. You know, you start off with this burst and it just gets your hopes up and you're going like, wow. And then suddenly it slows down. See, the question people debate all the time is, should you only have like a week long Kickstarter so you don't have the doll in town? But I don't know. What would your advice be after you've gone through this experience?
I would never do a week. I would do at least a 30-day Kickstarter.
Okay. So yes. Just expect it's going to go that way. If it doesn't go that way, that's unusual.
Yeah.
See, that's good. That's good advice for people because, you know, I know so many people, I mean, they get crushed after this initial burst, and not everybody is as good as you are with it. You know, 44 hours, that's wonderful. Some people don't get their goal until, if they're lucky, right before it's about to stop.
Yes.
And so they have a lot more nervousness than you probably had. Once you got your goal, then it's all, you know, well, I've got my goal. I know I'm getting the money. So that's not a bad thing. So that's a good thing for you. I'm glad it went that way for you. Was this your first Kickstarter?
Yes, it was our first Kickstarter.
Wow. So you had a good experience with that, because I know several people who have the first Kickstarter doesn't make it, and they learn things the hard way as a result.
Yeah, my wife Tina she is pretty tenacious when she sets her mind to doing something, but before she jumps into the pool, she does her homework extensively. So she asked a lot of questions to a lot of people and really set herself up for, the execution. And once she started executing it, you know, improvising on the fly and trying to get that needle to move.
Cool.
But yeah, I mean, it was a huge learning experience. And she whispered to me when we were just talking about the 30-day thing, she whispered to me, "I disagree with you."
That is that hard time. Those 2 weeks are tough to take.
Yes.
They really are. Now, one of the things I noticed somebody did not take you up on is something that I always promise myself I'm going to do. They could have gotten their character likeness in issue number 2, but nobody bought it. I'm sorry to see that, because, you know, that's one of the things I always wish. You know, granted, you were asking for $100, which is a little much for my blood. I couldn't do that probably, but I always wish somebody would, because it's fun to see real people in the books.
I thought there was.
Didn't you? Because when I looked at it, there's a bonus character likeness.
Didn't somebody purchase the being drawn in a book?
We sold 3 of them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We sold 3 of them.
Oh, really? Because when I look on the website, it says 0 backers. So maybe it may.
She said there's still one left if you want it. Oh.
Well, unfortunately, right now, $100 is a little rich for my blood. You can't do that. But that's good. Well, I'm glad to hear that, because I always think that's a real draw, is to see you in a comic book. I just think that that's a wonderful thing, because as all of us who have been reading for years and years, the thing we always wish, and I don't begrudge Stan Lee always wanting to put his image all over the place, because, you know, hey, you've done this long. It's the fun part is probably to see yourself in there.
Yeah.
So, well, I'm glad to hear that. I was kind of disappointed that on here it says 0, and I was like, oh, it's too bad.
Huh.
That would have been fun.
Well, yeah, we sold 3 out of 4.
Oh, cool. Well, that's great. I'm glad to hear that.
When you were talking about that, I was like, cause I know I had a conversation with Amon about where we were going to put these people.
Because, yeah, it said 0 on here. But, well, you know, hey, you know, the website, the internet's not always right.
Yeah.
You know, about these things. People always say, well, that's great. I'm glad to hear that. If I can scare up $100, I'll figure out how to do that. But
okay. Just drop us a line, give us a call, let us know.
Yeah.
There's always issue 2.
That's true. That's right. Issue 3 could go on. Well, that, of course, leads to the next question. Are you guys going to Kickstarter? Did you make enough so that you don't have to Kickstarter for the next issue? Or how is this going to go?
I think we're going to Kickstarter for the second issue as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that'll be good. Yeah, it's, you know, Kickstarter, as I like to say on the show, it makes things happen that, say, 10 years ago or 12, 15 years ago, we would never have seen, because people didn't have the money and the ability or the access that we have now.
And, you know, it's funny because a year ago, we couldn't see ourselves doing it, but this was all brought on by COVID, because we had worked on stuff all winter long and were ready to go to the shows with new stuff. Mm-hmm. And then COVID hit and all the shows canceled, and we needed to recoup some of that money. Mm-hmm. So we got online and, you know, we upped our presence. I got the website up and running, and it's got the store on there now. And we started doing the weekly live draws and this and that and the other. And yeah, I mean, and run a Kickstarter during the middle of a pandemic is, you know, but people were doing it and they were being successful at it. So that was a part of the research that Tina was finding was, well, people are doing it and they're funding, you know, so let's do it.
Well, I saw someplace, somebody told me that Kickstarter was actually asking people to do Kickstarter projects. Really? Because they felt they were behind and they needed more people to go on there and do more Kickstarter. So you were right with the flow. That's what they wanted. They wanted people to come on and do those kinds of things.
Yeah, I know that the demand for stuff is a lot more because people are, you know, with Hollywood shutting down and no new content becoming available, people are turning to comic books and stuff like that online because they're thirsting for new entertainment, new content, and mm-hmm. they're getting it with the independent market because we didn't put the pencils down.
Yeah, and not only that, they're looking to comics for inspiration. Now things are starting to gear up again for maybe, you know, you might see Road, you know, you might see your book suddenly turn into a TV movie or a theater movie or something like that.
Wouldn't that be terrible?
I was going to say, what would your reaction be if somebody came, hey, we got this pile of money and we want to turn your show into a movie? Because, I mean, you know, Walking Dead, I mean, all this stuff, you know, horror is a big deal as far as television and movies go. So,
oh yeah, I would ask them where I needed to sign.
I was talking to Mike Mahak last week, who does Cleopatra in Space, and he's got a TV show now. They've turned it into a TV show on the Peacock streaming
network. Oh wow!
And he's pretty happy with it. And many times I've talked with creators, and somebody gets a hold of their property and they start to do it. And when they start to look at what the final product is, it hardly resembles the thing that they, you know, were originally doing. And they always say, well, why don't you just take the name off? Because, you know, at this point, it doesn't look anything like our stuff. But he's very happy with it. They have made some changes. They've done some things with the characters that are different than what he did. But he's kind of happy with that. He wants to see the franchise evolve and grow. And so I'm kind of fascinated with that. Your stuff, I think, though, I bet you yours, especially with CGI being as it is right now, I bet you could get a really scary show out of your story.
Yeah. I would be all over that. And I've had a few podcasters ask me if that was part of my thought processes when I was writing the book. My answer was always yes, because the when the stories come to me, you know, I always tell Tina that, you know, she'll look at me and she can tell. And she'll just ask, are they talking to you again? And I'll say, yes. And she said, who is it this time? And, you know, is it peanut pudding and jelly? Is it pitter patter? Is it, you know, who is it? Is it Ace and Tess? You know, and I'll, you know, I'll have to grab the phone or I'll have to grab something to start writing things down. They just come to me. And Roadkill Rampage is definitely, it was very cinematic in my mind when I created it and wrote it. And when I thumbnailed it out, and Eamon will tell you this, what I gave him for the first issue, because I completely thumbnailed out the book and did the same thing with issue two. And I tell him, I said, you know, this is not a roadmap. This is a guide, you know, but there are a few things that I want you to draw exactly what I've got. I said, but everything else is, you know, you're the artist and, you know, I want you to be able to have the freedom to do what you do. But yeah, it's very cinematic in my mind. There was a movie back in the 70s called Dirty Mary and Crazy Larry with Peter Fonda in it. And I saw that movie when I was probably 6 years old on the ABC Movie of the Week on Friday night. That's dating me. And I could relate to it because they were on the roads and they were traveling. And we did that. We moved to Evansville, Indiana from Cincinnati, Ohio when I was 5 years old. And every weekend, or just about every weekend, we would drive back to Cincinnati so my mom could see her family. So we spent a lot of time on the roads, on the highways. And so that movie particularly spoke to me. Because that was us. And, you know, so a lot of the imagery from that. And are you familiar with the movie?
Sort of. It's been a long time since I've seen it, but yeah.
So the way that it ends really stuck with me, has always stuck with me from the time I saw it the first time. And that, just that imagery of how they shot that, you know, it's always stuck with me. And it definitely had a huge influence on Roadkill Rampage.
Well, that's cool. So there's four issues in this. And again, if you want to get Roadkill Rampage, unfortunately for you, the Kickstarter is over, but you can still go to Hazm, HAZZUM. It's just Hazm.com, right? It's
yes, not Hazm.com, yes.
Which leads me to a question, though. I am the kind of guy that wants to know why.
Okay.
Where did Hazm come from? Is that an abbreviation for something?
No, what is it? I have an older brother that is mentally disabled. And he has his isms, as everybody does. And he has a hard time pronouncing his R, so he's always called me Wani. Which thus my email is WaniWorld@Hotmail. So he has always said, you know, don't have a Hazm. Don't have a Hazm. He'd always don't have a Hazm. And I asked him one time, I said, well, you know, what do you mean don't have a Hazm? He said, you know, just chill out. You know, just relax. So, you know, it's to me, when you sit down to read your comic books, you're relaxing. You're chillaxing. You're having a Hazm. You're relaxing. So we were trying to come up with a name for it. And I said, oh, I know it's gotta be Hazm. And she was like, I don't know. You know, I said, once people realize what it's from and what it represents, they're going to dig it. And, you know, I've told this story, you know, 100 times since we launched the Kickstarter, and everybody loves the origin of it. So, yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. So other projects you're working on, you've talked about the other two books that you did. Was it three books? And Hazm has several books coming out. What is coming out that we should be looking forward to?
Well, we've got issue two of Roadkill Rampage. Eamon is currently working on that. And I am halfway through scripting issue three. I just got back the edits from Casey Pierce on issue two of Pitter Patter. That is our all ages cat book. So I will be jumping into finishing penciling that issue. And after that, I don't know. We'll take it from there. Right now, we're just concentrating on finishing up the script for issue three of Roadkill Rampage and jumping into issue two of Pitter Patter.
Cool.
And if anything else presents itself, we'll do that. And I'm, you know, we're on every Thursday night and Friday night on The Art of Rodney Fike and Hazm at YouTube, 8 o'clock Eastern time, Sean Forney and I, and we get on there and we draw, we do a 30-minute sketch off Thursday nights and Friday nights. And we invite people to join the Facebook page and vote on who we draw. And the drawings are for sale, and we just spend a couple hours and just talk all things nerdy.
Well, that's cool. How long have you been doing that?
We started doing that about 6 weeks ago.
Wow.
Yes, and it's we're starting to build an audience. We've got a group of regulars that show up, and we're working on trying to expand that audience. We just created a fan page 2 weeks ago. Was it 2 weeks ago, baby? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's 2 weeks ago, so it's on Facebook. Join the fan page. And like this Thursday night, we're drawing the New Mutants.
Oh, just in honor of the movie.
Yeah, in honor of the movie. And then Friday we were going to draw the Hellions. But then with the passing of Chadwick Boseman, we discussed and decided that Friday we're going to draw the Black Panther.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. So
very good. Well, it's all good stuff. It's great fun. I'm big on all ages stuff because I think, you know, sometimes all ages used to mean stupid, and I don't think that's the case anymore. I think there's a lot of good all ages stuff that's coming out, and I think your stuff is great fun for families and for kids.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's a lot of, you know, the pitter patter book. It's so getting the script back and having Casey, you know, say it's a great script. You know, just a couple of, I tend to use italics and bolds too much, and you know, she bangs on me for it, and rightfully so. But her closing comment was, you know, it was a great script, loved it. You know, it's like, yes, you know, I'm trying to be silly. I'm very heavily influenced by the Warner Brothers cartoons that I grew up on, and Tom and Jerry, and you know, and to me, Pitter Patter is just that. It's Bugs Bunny and Daffy. You know, just they've got a straight man and a funny man. And I just, when I was writing the end of the story, I just started belly rolling, laughing just hysterically. And you know, I'm just a big kid. You know, I love writing it. It's a lot of fun. I can't wait for people to look at it and look at me and wonder what the heck's wrong with me.
Well, that's good. So what about social media? If we want to follow your stuff, what's the best way for us to do that?
We are The Art of Rodney Fike on Facebook. And I am on Instagram, Rodney_Fike on Instagram. Also, we are Rodney Fike Art on Twitch, Hasm.com. Go there and see that. I do a blog on there, too, if you want to go check that out. There's two installments up currently right now, and it's about doing comics in the 90s. So you can go read those. There are more coming. And, Facebook, Art of Rodney Fike. Rodney Fike in general, Rodney Fike Art on Twitch, and Rodney_Fike on Instagram, and then Hasm.com.
That's cool.
And all things Fike.
That's right. Just so people know, it's F-Y-K-E.
Yes, F-Y-K-E. People get
that right. Well, Rodney, you're doing wonderful stuff, and I wish you much success. I'm glad the Kickstarter was a big success, and maybe next time I'll actually get it worked out where we can talk during the Kickstarter instead of after. That'd be nice to do.
Yes, that'd be cool. And I appreciate you taking the time to do it post Kickstarter, and I got to meet somebody new and make a new friend, so that's even better.
That's always good fun. And so, Rodney, keep it up and do wonderful stuff and keep the good stuff coming. I'm going to be fascinated to see what happens in issue two, because issue one was like, yikes. So issue two is going to be like, I'll be looking forward to see.
Yeah, I can't wait to start seeing some of the – I'm getting character roughs from him, and can't wait to start getting pages from him. So
it should be fun.
Yes.
All right. We'll have to talk again when that starts to
– Absolutely. Absolutely. We will definitely reach out to you.
And that's a wrap for this episode. If this weekend is a holiday one for you, have a great time. And even if it isn't, we'll see you next week. So until then, keep reading your comics.
It's over, Joker.
Over? Why, my dear delusional Dark Knight, it hasn't even begun.